a pleasure after the break for Purim last week. A pleasure to welcome back for the mid part, part three of our five part series, Rav Meir, the aftermath of the Bar Kochba revolt. Bavakasha Shuli.
Okay. Hi, everybody. Happy after Purim. That means you're allowed to say happy Purim. Hi, Shuli. Hi, everybody.
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you too. All right, let's get started. A lot to talk about. We are in the post Bar Kochba revolt. So last time, I know 2 weeks ago, it was a long time ago, before Purim, before all the drinking, we talked about Bar Kochba. Today, we're going to talk about the generation afterwards. In many ways, the Bar Kochba revolt, and we mentioned this last time, is more traumatic than the Great Revolt that happened 65 years earlier. Yes, of course, the Great Revolt ends with Churban HaBayit, right? It ends with the destruction of the temple. It's a very, very traumatic and terrible event. And yet, Jews are not officially kicked out of Jerusalem. They are not uprooted from Yehuda, from Judea. And perhaps most significantly, they don't have any decrees against them in terms of religion or rabbinic leadership. But the Bar Kochba revolt does have all those things. And so it is really a very, very traumatic event that Judaism has to rebuild itself from. And if we had Yavne and Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, who has to rebuild from having no temple, now we have to rebuild from having almost no Torah leadership. So that's really what we're going to talk about today. The move to the north, where does the Sanhedrin go? Who are this generation of survivors? And I'm using that term. I realize it's a loaded term, but I'm using it deliberately because I really do think that we're talking about a trauma, perhaps not on the level, God forbid, of the Holocaust. Everything is dwarfed by the Holocaust, right, in Jewish history. But unfortunately, we have many tragedies preceding the Holocaust. And I think one of the things that our generation understands is this concept of a catastrophic event having an impact on the next generation. And that's one of the things we're going to see here. Not everybody has an impact, and not everybody's impacted in the same way. We're going to talk mainly about Rabbi Meir, but others as well. The picture that I brought you here is from a beautiful project that was started in Israel a few years ago called the Sanhedrin Trail, Shvil HaSanhedrin. It actually starts, interestingly enough, because the tourism industry decided to create something that they call the Gospel Trail, right? Following in the footsteps of Jesus in the Galil, Jesus and his disciples. And of course, there were Jews who came and said, hold on, you know, we've got a little history here as well. Maybe we could create a trail following in the footsteps of the Sanhedrin, because as we know, the Sanhedrin moves north from Yavne after Bar Kochba. We're going to talk about today two of those stations, Usha and Shfaram, and next time we're going to talk about Beit She'arim and Sipori, and Tveria, of course, Tveria hi'amukam mikulam, it's the lowest, the deepest of all, and so there is a trail that goes to most of these places, not everywhere, but most of it, as well as a few other places, Yodfat, Arbel, and along the way, besides seeing the antiquities and enjoying the hiking and the outdoors, they put up all these nice signs that have sayings from Chazal that are connected in some way to where you are. So this is one of the stones, one of the markers by Usha, which is at the beginning of the trail. And we'll see where that is in a few minutes. We'll see the map. But here we have a Mishnah in Gittin that talks about Pidyon Shvuyim, right? Redeeming captives. En podim et ha-shvuyim yeter al kedei mehem mipnei tikun olam ve'en mavrim. So you have to redeem captives. We know redeeming captives is a very idea of paramount importance in Jewish law. And yet we don't want to pay exaggerated prices because that will only encourage the enemies to take more captives, right? We don't want to encourage very high ransoms. This is one of the takanot, one of the laws that comes out of Usha, which we're going to discuss. And it's partly because of the story of Bar Kochba. Bar Kochba revolt ends not only with terrible massacre, right? Murder of many Jews, but many, many, many Jews are taken prisoner, are sold as slaves, and Jewish communities saw their responsibility to redeem them, but not at the cost of financial ruination. So that's very apt to put this on the stone. That's by Usha, as well as another one that talks also, we're going to see economics as an important element of the post-Bar Kokhba era. Gidola milacha hamechabedet et ba'alea. It's very good to go to work, right? Work makes a person have dignity. So just to review our timeline very quickly, hey, Bar Kokhba Revolt 132 to 135 CE. Bar Kokhba, of course, is ultimately defeated and killed. Rabbi Akiva, the spiritual father, the spiritual leader of the revolt, is also killed, executed by the Romans. And we're going to deal now with the aftermath, with what happens afterwards. Again, I remind everyone, if you have questions, please put them in the chat and I will try to address them all at the end. Okay, so what happens at the end? First of all, we have Hadrian, right? Hadrian is, in general, Roman history, something of a hero. He's considered one of the five good emperors. In Jewish history, he's Adrianus Chikatzamot, Hadrian, that his bones should rot, should, you know, be worn away. So Hadrian is triumphant, but there are also losses, right? And we know that in the letter, the standard letter that Roman generals would write back to the Senate after their battles or their victories, they start by saying, I and my army are well. Hadrian doesn't say that after the Bar Kokhba revolt. So it's a fierce battle. Ultimately, he is triumphant, and he acknowledges that or celebrates that with statues, with enormous signs and archways. This massive thing on the right here, this is a drawing of something that, a replica of what we think it looked like, for a place called Tel Shalem near Beit Sha'an. What we found, you can see this in the Israel Museum, is pieces of this enormous inscription. And obviously the person here is to give you a sense of the scale, right? Romans are never very shy about celebrating their triumphs. Other results of this, first of all, one of the fascinating things is that Jews go down in Roman eyes, right? If we had a phenomenon in the 100 years preceding the Bar Kokhba revolt that Jews are made fun of, right? There's anti-Semitism, but Jews are also admired because Judaism and Torah, and we know there are converts, the moral system is admired by people in the Roman Empire, especially those people who don't have it so good, which is most of the Romans, right? Unless you're male and with property, you don't have a very good situation in life in the Roman Empire. Nobody else is important. Along comes Judaism and says, everybody is Nivra B'Tselem. Everybody is created in God's image. And many Romans are attracted to that idea. It's a beautiful idea. And you have some converts. You also have people who are called God-fearers, who are kind of sympathetic to Judaism. Bar Kokhba revolt shows everybody, unfortunately, that Judaism is being stepped on and Judaism goes down in the eyes of the Romans. And the kind of unintended consequence of that is you still have these spiritual seekers, but rather than seeking Judaism, they seek something that's also with a spiritual message, with a lot less of a cost in terms of commandments, and that's Christianity. Right? And we're going to see 100 years later, 150 years later, Christianity becomes the religion of the Roman Empire. One other important consequence in terms of internal Jewish history, okay, and we see this kind of written back into the story that the rabbis tell about Bar Kokhba, is an anti-military stance. Now, the rabbis don't like Bar Kokhba. The stories that are written about him are portraying him as very ruthless, which as we saw last time, he really was, but without any very redeeming factors. And the trend in rabbinic thought for the next 1800 years, basically until the 20th century, is to be against any kind of military adventure, that Jews are off the stage of history in terms of fighting for sovereignty and being militant. And that only begins to change with Zionism. So that's a huge impact that the Bar Kokhba revolt has. In terms of practical things that happen, the Romans go ahead and they say, two revolts within 70 years, enough, we've had it. We have to erase Jewish identity from Jerusalem and from Judea. And the question is, does that work? And the answer, of course, is no, right? It works on a physical sense. It does not work on a spiritual sense. But what do they do? What do they actually do? First of all, they go with the name, right? Romans understand the symbolic importance of names. And rather than calling the province Judea, Provincia Judea, they take away that idea of Judea and they call it Palestina, which is the name that continued till today, right? Palestine coming from the word plishti. There are no plishtim. There are no more Philistines. Philistines disappeared hundreds of years earlier. But Romans take this name that is the symbol, the name of the Jews' most hated enemy in biblical times, and apply it to our region. We're going to erase the Jewish connection. We're going to emphasize the non-Jewish connection. Now, Jews never use that name, by the way. If you look in Jewish sources, we never call this land Palestina, right? Palestine, yes, in the 1910s, 1920s, pre-Israel, Jews did call this land Palestine. But in rabbinic literature, later literature, it's always Eretz Yisrael. It's always the land of Israel, Eretz Yehuda, the Galil, but we don't use that term Palestine. But that's how the Romans relate. That's how they call this place. And Aelia Capitolina becomes the new name of Jerusalem. Jerusalem temple, of course, has been destroyed. The Temple Mount now has a pagan temple on top of it. And the Romans create certain elements that make it into a Roman city. So for example, they have a few forums, right? These big fancy sidewalks, marketplaces. The picture that you see here on the right is a picture underneath modern day Damascus Gate, Shaar Shechem, where we can see the Roman sidewalk, okay? And they repave certain areas. Also, if you go further into the Muslim Quarter in the Via Dolorosa, you can see, again, underground, another one of these forums, and they create triumphal arches. Now, the picture on the left is an amazing picture, okay? You may recognize Shaar Shechem, Damascus Gate. And in the 1970s, after Jerusalem was reunited, Israel decided to create a very beautiful plaza kind of leading into Damascus Gate, which is a very important gate in Jerusalem. And in the course of the work to create this plaza, they uncovered something that they knew was there, but it had been covered up. But archaeologists knew it was there, but they managed to uncover it. And that's this smaller arch right next to it, right? Now, this was a piece of a three arches that were freestanding. Roman times, second century, the walls around Jerusalem have been destroyed. Hadrian does not rebuild the walls. It takes till Byzantine times till the walls are rebuilt. But this is a freestanding triumphal arch, a victory arch that's built by Hadrian. And there's an inscription above it that talks about Colonia Aelia Capitolina, right? The colony of Aelia Capitolina, that's the new name that the Romans give to Jerusalem. And in order to create this city, right, here you have a coin of the Emperor Hadrian, and on the obverse, on the other side of the coin, you can see, it's actually amazing to see it, you can see these two oxen, right, and the person behind them, pushing them, the oxen are pulling a plow. What do Romans do when they create a new city or they conquer a city, right? They symbolically plow furrows that show the boundaries of the city. Now, Jews see that imagery, and what comes to mind is a much, much older statement by the prophet Micha, and long before we knew about Romans and Roman practices. The prophet Micha, when he talks about the destruction of Jerusalem, he says, Tzion sadeh techerash. Tzion will be like a plowed field. And this is how the rabbis relate to this Roman plowing, creating this new city. Now, this is a city that is Judenrein. There are no Jews allowed in the city. And that we know about from various sources. One of them here is a Christian writer named Eusebius from Caesarea. This is a good century and a half after it happens, but we have no reason to suspect that it's not correct. Okay? In his history, he writes, in Hadrian's year 18, as in the year 134 CE, the Jewish war that was conducted in Palestine reached its conclusion, all Jewish problems having been completely suppressed. From that time on, permission was denied them even to enter Jerusalem, first and foremost because of the commandment of God, as the prophets had prophesied, right? Obviously, he's taking a very Christian approach that Jews are kicked out of Jerusalem because of their rejection of Jesus. That's not what the Romans are thinking, but that's what the Christians are thinking. And secondly, by authority of the interdictions of the Romans. The Romans forbid the Jews to enter Jerusalem. And with very rare exceptions, okay, Jerome in the fourth century writes about how Jews were permitted to enter every year on Tisha B'Av. They paid for the right to come and mourn at the Kotel. But other than that, Jews are kept out of Jerusalem until the Muslim era, right? Until the Muslims come, 500 years that the Jews are out of Jerusalem, with perhaps a couple of exceptions here and there. We don't really know. Okay. Now, the question I asked before, does it work, right? Is Jerusalem taken out of the hearts and minds of Jews? And the answer, of course, is no, right? We all know the answer is no. But what happens is that we no longer have an earthly Jerusalem for a good few centuries. We can't go to Jerusalem. We can't visit Jerusalem. So what do? We have Yerushalayim Shalmala, right? We have heavenly Jerusalem. We have descriptions of Jerusalem. Think about the Gemara, right? The Mishnah and the Gemara, which are written down and are discussed largely after the temple has been destroyed. How many conversations and discussions about the temple, about Jerusalem, about what things look like? Jerusalem is kept alive and is idealized to a great extent in the hearts and minds of the people. And the Romans are not able to take this away from us. But in terms of a physical entry to Jerusalem, we are not allowed in. The Romans also want to, they see that this is a country of troublemakers. And so they decide to upgrade their road system, which was already pretty sophisticated, and to add more and more lines, right? In Rome, all roads lead to Rome, but in Judea, all roads lead to Aelia Capitolina or Jerusalem, as you can see in this great map here, which shows you Roman milestones that have been discovered and major roads, right? Roads like Derech Ha'avot, the Path of the Patriarchs, coming from Beersheba, going up through Gush Etzion, Jerusalem, and further north. Okay, the road that went from Jerusalem out past Beit Guvrin to the coast, right? Very famous, very important road, and other roads as well, going down to Jericho. If the Romans improve the road system, what that means is they can get their troops where they need to go as quickly and efficiently as possible. Now, good roads are not just, you know, a good thing for Roman troops. They're good for all sorts of things, right? They're good for trade. They're good for travel, for tourism. And there are Jews who appreciated the roads. And we're going to see, right, in a foreshadowing of the famous Monty Python sketch, what have the Romans done for us lately, right? We're going to see how Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai takes on somebody who says, well, but we have all these great roads. And he says, haha, you think the roads are for you? We're going to come to that in a little while. Now, the roads are not only to physically get the army from one place to another. The roads are also a form of propaganda. All along the roads, and that's what these little black columns signify over here, right? All along the roads are milestones. This is a milestone on the right here. This is actually pre-Bar Kokhba. It's from the first century of the Common Era, but we have ones that are post-Bar Kokhba as well. I like this one because it was very clear writing. What's a milestone? A milestone essentially has two sections and two pieces of information. Okay. One piece is in Greek, and that's kind of the practical stuff. How many miles, Roman miles, to the next big town? Right. So, for example, right near my house here in Gush Etzion, we found Roman milestones that say 12 Roman miles to Jerusalem. And there's another one that says 10 Roman miles to Jerusalem along Derech Ha'avot, along the path of the patriarchs. That's the practical stuff, right? That's the highway sign that we're all familiar with. But there's also a different part, and that's the Latin part that says that this milestone was built by Caesar, Imperator, whoever it might be, right? Whether it's Hadrian or Antoninus Pius, or any of the various Caesars. And often you'll have clusters of milestones because one Caesar built the road and the next Caesar improved the road and the next one, right? So next to, not so far from Beit Shemesh, a place called Giva Ishayahu, they found a whole bunch of milestones, three of them together in one place because they are stages of the road being fixed. Now, what's the idea here? This is a form of not so subtle propaganda. This is subliminal advertising, right? As you are clomping along the road on your donkey, every Roman mile you see Caesar Imperator, and it gets drilled into your head after a while that this is the guy in charge, right? You need, it's repeated over and over again. The Roman presence is very successfully conveyed, not just through the Roman soldiers, but even through this more subtle form of propaganda. So Roman presence, Romans in Jerusalem, Roman names, but much stronger than all these things, we have what are called by the rabbis Gezerot Hashmad, okay, decrees against Judaism. And here again is where the Bar Kokhba revolt differs from the Great Revolt. The Great Revolt is really about sovereignty and independence. It's about economics and how the governors are, the Roman governors are taking advantage of the people, but it's really not very much about religion. The Bar Kokhba revolt is about religion. Now, Are these decrees against Judaism happening before the revolt and they precipitate it? Are they afterwards as a punishment? Are they during? Not so clear, right? Not so clear, but we find many different places where they are referred to by the rabbis, right? We hear about them in a lot of different places all over Chazal. I brought you two examples. And by the way, almost all of them are decrees against positive mitzvot, mitzvot aseh. Meaning the Romans don't come and force anyone to eat pig, to violate Shabbos, mostly, right? Mostly they don't allow them to do things like wear tefillin, okay, or do brit milah, or read from the Torah, okay? And we have one example here, a very powerful one, the Mechilta de Rabbi Yishmael. Rabbi Natan says, for my lovers and the keepers of my mitzvot, la'ohavayu l'shomrei mitzvotai. How does he explain that verse? The Jews who dwell in Eretz Yisrael and give their lives for the mitzvot. Why are you going out to be executed? Because I circumcised my son. Why are you going out to be burned? Because I read the Torah. Why are you going out to be crucified? Because I ate matzah. Why are you being given 100 lashes? Because I took the lulav, right? All of these different things that entail that being punished terribly by the Romans if you are caught. Some people defiantly go against these decrees, okay? People like Rabbi Akiva, we're going to see Rabbi Hanina ben Tradion. Some people use subterfuge, and we have this crazy story in the Gemara and Shabbos, right, about somebody named Elisha Baal Knafayim, Elisha the man of wings. What? They mention him. This is how the Gemara does things, right? Stop. They mention him in relation to something else. And they say, well, why did they call him that? Because on one occasion, the evil kingdom of Rome issued a decree against Israel that as a punishment, they would pierce the brain of anyone who dons phylacteries, right? It's very symbolic. You put the tefillin on your head, they will attack your head. Nevertheless, Elisha would don them and defiantly go out to the marketplace. Okay, so he is defiant, but one day an official who was appointed to enforce a decree saw him. Elisha ran away from him. The official ran after him. When the official reached him, Elisha removed the phylacteries from his head and held them in his hand. The officer asked him, what is that in your hand? Elisha said to him, it is merely a dove's wings. Right? And there are all kinds of nice midrashic interpretations why particularly a dove's wings. A miracle was performed. He opened his hands, and indeed, it was found to be a dove's wing, right? God did a miracle for him, and the tefillin were turned into a dove. Therefore, in commemoration of this miracle, they called him Elisha, man of wings, Elisha Baal Knafayim. There were different approaches among the rabbis about these gzirot hashmad, and we saw this a little bit last time. There were rabbis who said, no, don't do any of these things. There are only three things that you need to die for, right? Murder, idolatry, and sexual sins. And other rabbis said, no. In the time of shmad, in the time of these terrible decrees, even if the goyim tell you not to tie your shoelaces the way the Torah says, you have to tie them in the way the Torah says, and you have to die for that. So we have different approaches to this. Some are very defiant, and some are, lay low, things will work out okay. Now, perhaps the most damaging, definitely the most damaging of all the decrees is the one that there should be no ordination, no smicha, right? You are not allowed to create the next generation of rabbis. And we have this very famous story, the Gemara in Sanhedrin. There are those who say perhaps it's hyperbole, perhaps it's written down later, but it's a very, very powerful story about Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava, who goes against these terrible decrees in order to be somech, in order to ordain the next generation of leadership. So we have this Gemara in Sanhedrin on the left here. One time the wicked kingdom of Rome issued decrees of religious persecution against the Jewish people. They said anyone who ordains judges will be killed. Anyone who is ordained will be killed. The city in which they ordained the judges will be destroyed. The signs identifying the boundaries of the cities in which they ordained judges will be uprooted. What did Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava do? Okay, so he doesn't want any city to be destroyed. He went and sat between two large mountains, between two large cities, and between two Shabbat boundaries, between Usha and Shfaram. Before we continue the story, which is a very, very powerful story, just interject an archaeological element, which is very beautiful. On the outskirts of the ancient city of Shfaram, there was a stone that was found, and that's what you have in the picture here on the right. And it says in Roman, in Latin letters, C-A-B, which we believe stands for Shabbat. Okay? And we think that this is the Tum Shabbat stone. How did you know how far you were allowed to go on Shabbat without going outside of the boundaries of Shabbat? There were stones on the outskirts of various cities. So this is the Shabbat boundary of Usha. And this is where Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava goes beyond this boundary and before the boundary of Shfaram. We'll see in the map in a few minutes. Okay? And he went between them and he ordained five elders, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Yossi, and Rabbi Elazar ben Shammua. Okay? And we'll see that these are largely the people who are going to carry on Torah in the post-Bar Kokhba generation. Okay? When their enemies discovered them, Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava said to the newly ordained sages, "My sons, run for your lives." They said to him, "My teacher, what will be with you?" Right? He's older than them. He's a contemporary of Rabbi Akiva. He can't run away. Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava was elderly and unable to run. He said to them, "In any case, I am cast before them like a stone that cannot be overturned." Okay, and he was basically the bait. They were able to escape. He could not. The Roman soldiers did not move from there till they had inserted 300 iron spears into him, making him appear like a sieve pierced with many holes. What a terrible ending. And with regard to Rabbi Meir, we're going to talk about, did Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava actually ordain him? Doesn't Rabbi Bar Chana say that Rabbi Yochanan says, anyone who says that Rabbi Akiva did not ordain Rabbi Meir is nothing other than mistaken? We hear that Rabbi Akiva ordained Rabbi Meir. We're going to see that in a few minutes. The Gemara answers, Rabbi Akiva, in fact, ordained Rabbi Meir, but the people did not accept the appointment as Rabbi Meir was still very young. So here we have Rabbi Meir as a very young student, a very promising student of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva ordains him, but he's not old enough yet, right? And he has to be ordained again by Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava. Now, the other source here, right, it gives us a sense of who these people are and why they are so significant. And Gemara later on in Sanhedrin says, just telling you in case you were wondering, and Rabbi Yochanan says, an unattributed Mishnah is in accordance with the opinion of Rabbi Meir, an unattributed Braita, Rabbi Nechemiah, an unattributed Sifra, Rabbi Yehuda, an unattributed Sifri, Rabbi Shimon. And all of these are in accordance with the opinion of Rabbi Akiva. So Rabbi Akiva teaches this next generation. Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava ordains them, and the Torah is in their hands. Without them, there's not going to be Torah in the next generation. This is a burden that is very heavy on them. And we'll see how it reflects on them. Just a little more about Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava. This is where this Tum Shabbat stone is between Usha and Shfaram. In Shfaram itself, on the outskirts of Shfaram, there is a place that is the traditional grave of Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava. And Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava is quoted in the Medrash as being with another significant personality who we're going to meet in another minute, Rabbi Hanina ben Tradion, the father of Bruria. And they are together when they hear of the execution of Rabbi Akiva, and they put on sackcloth, and Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava says this is a sign that many more people are going to be killed, that disaster is going to befall the Jewish people, and he and Rabbi Hanina ben Tradion see themselves as needing to continue the fight, and both of them martyr themselves in different ways. But after this terrible sacrifice, the Roman leadership changes. Hadrian dies. There's a new emperor, Antoninus Pius. And here he is in a statue, as well as in coins. And unlike his predecessor, unlike Hadrian, definitely unlike his pre-predecessor like Trajan, he is not a conqueror. He is not a military emperor. He's known as an intellectual, and he doesn't go on military campaigns, and he basically gets rid of these decrees. He sees that they're not necessary, and he kind of backs off from the Jews a little bit. He doesn't give them so much, but he, Antoninus Pius, undoes the decrees that Hadrian had given to the Jews, and things start to improve. The Jews are still lying low, but things start to improve. Now, interestingly enough, we hear in the Gemara about an Antoninus, a Roman Antoninus, an emperor who is good friends with Rebbe, with Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. And we have all these fascinating stories of the two of them and their conversations. Is that this Antoninus Pius? So it's possible. However, he's emperor till 161 and then he dies. Rebbe is usually considered to be like only beginning his career around that. So not necessarily, but possibly. And we're going to talk now about Usha and Shfaram, but I wanted to show you all the different places of the Sanhedrin. Almost all of them are here in this map. Okay, so we are, just to orient you a little, right? Over here is Haifa. Okay, down in this direction is the Kinneret and Tveria. And in between those two are the five cities that we hear about the Sanhedrin moving to. So we have Usha, which today is kind of just a small antiquities area by a modern Yishuv. We have Shfaram. Okay, so number one is Usha. Number two is Shfaram. Today, Shfaram is a large Arab town, Christian and Muslim. We're going to see what's left there. From Shfaram, the Sanhedrin moves to Beit She'arim, down here. From Beit She'arim, they move to Tzipori. Okay, and those are the two places we're going to talk about next time, Beit She'arim and Tzipori. And the final place is Tiberias, which is not on my map, but is all the way over here on the right. Okay, and there is this progression from one place to another, which all happens relatively quickly. Meaning by the time we get to Rebbe in the second half of the second century, they're already in Beit She'arim and Beit She'arim and Tzipori. Usha and Shfaram seem to be rather short-lived stops for the Sanhedrin. Why the movement? So one theory is that Usha and Shfaram are relatively isolated, small, unimportant places. The Romans don't really care about them. The rich Jews don't really care about them. The Sanhedrin can lie low and begin to rebuild itself. As it gets stronger, as the Romans give it a little more respect, the Jews give it a little more respect, they can continue to large and important cities like Tzipori and Tveria. There could be other factors. That's one of the factors that a lot of historians point to. So that's where we are. We are going to continue to Usha, okay? And the Sanhedrin begins to reestablish itself after the debacle of the Bar Kokhba revolt. We hear about a meeting in a place called Bik'at Beit Rimon with some of the prominent scholars, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yossi, all right, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And then there's this gathering in Usha, right? We have this very interesting source here from Shir HaShirim Rabbah, okay? Sorry, I brought it only in Hebrew because I didn't have it in English, but I'll translate it. Bishlafei Hashmad, at the end of the decrees, of these terrible decrees, Nitkansu Rabotenu Leusha, our rabbis gathered in Usha. The Eluhain, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Nechemiah, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, right? These are the names that we saw before with Rabbi Yehuda Ben Baba, Rabbi Elazar Ben Osha, Rabbi Yossi Aglili, Rabbi Elazar Ben Yaakov, right? And a couple of others. Shalchu Etzel Ziknei Hagad. They sent a message to the elders of the Galilee. Bamru, call me Shahu Lamed Yavovi Yelamed. Everyone who is learned, come and teach. Call me Shaino Lamed Yavovi Yomod. Anyone who is ignorant should come and learn. Hey, come to Usha and start to rebuild the Torah world. Nitkansu Vilamdu Vaatsu Kol Tzorkeim. So they had this convocation, and they started to study and to teach. And then when they decided it was time to break up for the day, right? This is the inauguration of the Sanhedrin in Usha. Kevan shehigiaz manam lipater, it was time to go home. Amru makom shenitkablanu bitocho, anu minichim oto rekam. They said, how could we leave this place that was so hospitable to us without saying some kind words? They allow Rabbi Yehuda, who's Rabbi Yehuda Bar Ilai, Rabbi Yehuda Stam, everywhere in the Mishnah is Rabbi Yehuda Bar Ilai, who's a resident of Usha. So he starts by saying praises of Torah, and then people say praises of Kvod Achzanya, of Usha. And they finish by saying, "Vatem achenu bnei Usha shekibaltem rabotenu b'sefer panim yafot al achat kama v'kama." You people of Usha, you accepted us with happy, smiling faces, right? And you provided us a home. So we have a few interesting things here, right? Usha welcomes in the rabbis, allows them to reestablish the Sanhedrin, which they don't know, by the way, if that's going to be a dangerous thing or not. We're just at the end of these decrees. Who knows what the Romans are going to do next? Okay. Usha is clearly a Jewish city, as you can see in the picture on the left. Mikvaot were found there in the new excavations that are being done here. The other thing that is fascinating, and we're going to see this very clearly with Rabbi Meir, is everybody is invited. If you know something, come and teach. If you don't know anything, come and learn. We need every Jew because we have been decimated and we need to rebuild. Okay, that's one of the challenges of Usha. We have other ones as well, okay? And we have this concept of takanot, of rabbinic enactments in Usha. There are a few scattered around the Gemara. The biggest collection that I've seen is in the Gemara in Ketubot. And you see a few themes that come out. First of all, we said before, the pidyon shvuyim, right? Bringing back the prisoners, freeing the prisoners. We also have issues that are economic, right? Take a look over here. Rabbi Eli said that Reish Lakish said in the name of Rabbi Yehuda Bar Chanina, in Usha, the sages instituted that a man should sustain his sons and daughters when they are minors. You have to feed your children. Did you know you have to feed your children? Feed your children. Okay, that comes from Usha. And the other way around, children have to feed their parents. Rabbi Eli said, Rabbi Lakish said, Reish Lakish said, in Usha, sages instituted that a case of one who writes a document stating he is giving all his property as a gift to his sons in his lifetime, he and his wife are sustained from the property to their death, right? I want to escape all those taxes. I'm going to give over my inheritance to my kids while I'm still alive, but I don't want to starve. So in Usha, they instituted that the children have to feed the parents. You have a sense of an economic disaster to a certain extent. And we have to ensure that children are fed, parents are fed, that people are taken care of. We also have this idea that don't waste your money, right? Another one, sages instituted in Usha, one who dispenses his money to charity should not dispense more than one-fifth, okay? And the final takana we have here in Ketubot, we also have one about another economic one about women's property. But here we have one about education, which we mentioned before. And this one might be one that you might want to tell your children or grandchildren. In Usha, the sages enacted a person should treat his son gently, even if he doesn't want to study, until his son is 12 years old. From this point forward, he harasses him in all aspects of his life in order to force him to study. So you get a free ticket till you're 12, and then you better start learning Torah. Okay, so everybody needs to study. Everybody needs to take part in this rebuilding. Another takana that we see, another theme, not here, but in other places, is Yishuv Haaretz, settling the land. People leave. It's difficult in the land of Israel. There's persecution, there's economic troubles, people are picking themselves up and moving. And in Usha, they start to say, okay, you can't sell land to non-Jews. Hey, you cannot raise sheep and goats because they're going to graze too much and ruin the land. We need to protect the land. And we also have people who are trying to create primacy in Babylonia. A famous story about the nephew of Rabbi Yoshua. Remember Rabbi Yoshua from last time? Hey, the nephew of Rabbi Yoshua, Hanania, who goes to Babylonia and starts to do the calendar in Babylonia, right? Leap years, all the different things that you do in the calendar that was done manually in those days. He starts to do it in Babylonia. This is an Eretz Yisrael priority. And the sages of Israel send a message to, they come, messengers come to Hanania and they say, what the heck are you doing? Why are you doing this? You're not allowed to change the calendar. This is only done in Eretz Yisrael. And Hanania says, well, there was nobody in Eretz Yisrael. There's no rabbinic leadership. And they said, you're wrong. You left behind baby goats, but they've grown up into full-grown goats that have strong horns. And if you don't listen to us and you don't stop taking away this priority that Eretz Yisrael is supposed to have, then we're going to send those goats that are going to attack you. Okay? And the Gemara says, "V'kol kach lama." Why are they making all, you know, being so tough? Kimitzion Tetzei Torah. Torah is supposed to come out of Zion, out of Eretz Yisrael. We have to protect the primacy of Eretz Yisrael against the Babylonian encroachment. Okay. After Usha, we move to Shfaram. Today, Shfaram is an Arab city. It's an Arab city in the Galil, meaning it's a relatively friendly Arab city. And there happens to be a very old synagogue in the Arab city, which the keys are held by an Arab family, and they take care of it, and they allowed Jews to come in and to see it. And this is a synagogue that is by tradition built on the site of the Sanhedrin that was in Shfaram. Other than that, not much in the way of archaeology in Shfaram. There could be much more under the surface, but we don't know very much. Okay, so now what we're going to do in the time that we have left is we're going to take a look at different survivors and how they reacted. So we're going to start with the very famous couple, okay, Rabbi Meir and Bruria, and I put as their motto, no Jew left behind, because that's their credo, that we have to accept everybody because we have to work to rebuild the Jewish people. And Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Meir is a young student of Rabbi Akiva. Okay? And this is the story that we have in Yevamot. Rabbi Akiva had 12,000 pairs of students from Gvat to Antipatris. They all died in one period of time because they did not treat each other with respect, right? And we said this is very likely that they're dying in the Bar Kokhba revolt. The world was desolate of Torah until Rabbi Akiva came to our rabbis in the south and taught his Torah to them. This group of disciples consisted of Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, right? The same people we keep hearing over and over again. And these are the ones who upheld the study of Torah at that time. So Rabbi Meir is a young student of Rabbi Akiva. He's ordained by Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava, but he also learns with Rabbi Akiva's contemporary in a different school of thought, Rabbi Yishmael. Take a look at the next Gemara here in Erevin. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi said, anywhere you find a statement introduced with a certain disciple said before Rabbi Akiva in the name of Rabbi Yishmael, it is none other than Rabbi Meir, who was a student who served both Rabbi Yishmael and Rabbi Akiva. So he has both of these traditions, right? He knows both of them, and he's also brilliant. Rabbi Acha bar Chanina said, it is revealed and known before the one who spoke and the world came into being. In the generation of Rabbi Meir, there was no one of the sages who is his equal. The Gemara in Erevin goes on about how brilliant Rabbi Meir was. One of the things that's interesting in how they describe him is that he could always see both sides of every issue. He could declare something pure, he could declare something impure, and he could prove it either way. And that's one of the reasons that the Gemara gives for the fact that he is not everybody went by his opinions because they didn't always understand what he really was for. He was able to see so many sides of an issue that it wasn't clear what his opinion was. He's someone who is very complex, but also very moderate, very inclusive. He makes his living as a scribe, right? He's a lavlar, which I thought is also interesting because he's literally carrying on the writing of the Torah. The picture that you're seeing here is an old picture of the kever of Rabbi Meir Baal Hanes, the grave in Tveria. We'll come back to that a little later. Both Bria and Rabbi Meir come from complicated backgrounds. Rabbi Meir, we have a tradition in Gemara and Gittin that talks about Rabbi Meir as a descendant of converts. We have this story about Nero. The Romans sent Nero against the Jews, right? Nero is before Vespasian, before Titus. He came to Jerusalem. He shot an arrow to the east. The arrow fell in Jerusalem. He shot an arrow to the west. It fell in Jerusalem. He shot an arrow in all four directions, and each time it fell in Jerusalem. He said to a child, tell me a verse you learned today, right? Psokli psukha. He said to him as follows, I will lay my vengeance upon Edom by the hand of the people, my people Israel. Nero said, the Holy One wishes to destroy his temple and he wishes to wipe his hands with that man, right? He doesn't want to be the one who's going to carry on this mission. If I continue this mission, I will eventually be punished for having served as God's agent to bring about the destruction. He fled and became a convert, and ultimately Rabbi Meir descended from him. Now, just to be clear, we have no records in Roman sources that Nero becomes a convert to Judaism. It's a very interesting idea, but we don't hear it anywhere else. But here, Rabbi Meir is portrayed as a descendant of a Roman emperor. Okay, so Rabbi Meir is already somewhat of an outsider. Okay, now Bria, his wife, has a very difficult background. Bria's father is Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion, who we mentioned before, who studies Torah in public against the decrees of the Romans. You may remember last time we talked about the encounter he has with Rabbi Yossi ben Kisma, who says, you're doing foolishness. Why are you doing this? But he just continues to teach Torah. The Romans brought Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion for judgment, and they said to him, why did you occupy yourself with Torah? And he says, the Lord commanded me. They sentenced him to death by means of burning, his wife to execution by decapitation, and his daughter was condemned to sit in a brothel. Now, his daughter is not Bria. Right? Take a look at the bottom, the last paragraph. Bria, the wife of Rabbi Meir, was a daughter of Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion. She said to Rabbi Meir, it's a disrespectful matter for me that my sister is sitting in a brothel. You must do something to save her. And we have a famous story that Rabbi Meir does go to save her. But Bria's father and mother are murdered by the Romans. Her sister is captured and disgraced. She is very aware of suffering and of terrible things that can happen in the world. Just to finish the story of Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion, because it's such a beautiful and famous story, he's wrapped up in a Torah scroll and he's set on fire. It's a horrible, cruel way to die. But his student said, "What do you see?" Rabbi Chanina said, and this is a famous statement, "I see the parchment burning, but its letters are flying to heaven." Right? Gvilin nisrafim v'otiyot porchot. Right? That the letters, the Torah, the meaning is going to continue. So Rabbi Chanina is a martyr. His wife is a martyr. His daughter is a martyr. And Bruria is the survivor. And she is, like we said, very attuned to suffering. Rabbi Meir is not only inclusive, but he is very, very kind. And he teaches the idea that we know of Hevemi Talmidav Shel Aharon, you should be of the students of Aharon. And he teaches the famous idea that Aharon would go and he would see, you know, people who had friends who had gotten into an argument, or a husband and wife. And he would go and he would say to the husband, "Oh, your wife says she really wants to make up with you." And he would go to the wife and he would say, "Oh, your husband really wants to make up with you." And then the two of them would get together and they would make up. And this is Rabbi Meir's teachings, but he also lives it in his life. And we have this famous story, right, that takes place in the synagogue of the city where Rabbi Meir lives. Rabbi Meir lives in a place called Chamat. Okay? Chamat is a little south of Tveria today. It's within Tveria. It precedes Tveria. We'll talk about what it is in a minute. There's a very beautiful, famous synagogue there. This is a mosaic floor, a piece of the mosaic floor from that synagogue, which postdates Rabbi Meir. The synagogue has earlier layers, but the mosaic is later. And he would teach Torah there on Shabbat. So here's the story. Rabbi Meir would teach Torah on Friday nights in the synagogue in Chamat, and there was a woman who used to listen to his lectures. One night, Rabbi Meir spoke for longer than usual, and the woman stayed till he finished. By the time she got home, the candles had already burned down, right? That's the only light they have, no Shabbos clocks, right? So you're eating in the dark. "Where were you?" demanded her husband. "I was listening to a Torah lecture," she answered. Her husband said to her, "I swear you will not enter my house till you go spit in the face of the rabbi who was lecturing." Not knowing what to do, she stayed outside till her neighbor said to her, "Come, let's go together to the rabbi." Rabbi Meir saw them coming. God gave him insight into the problem. He immediately pretended that his eye heard him. "I need someone to spit in my eye to cure it. Who can do it?" Her friends nudged her forward. "Spit in my eye 7 times and I'll be cured," Rabbi Meir told her. When she did, he told her, "Go home and tell your husband, you said I should spit once, but I spit 7 times. His students were appalled and said, "Rebbe, how could you let people disgrace you like that? When they disgrace a Torah scholar, they disgrace the Torah. If you had told us, we'd have forced her husband to let her come home." Rabbi Meir answered, "The honor of Meir is not greater than the honor of God. If the Torah tells us to erase the name of God for the sake of peace between a husband and wife," right, a sota, "surely Meir can be dishonored for the same reason." So he doesn't worry about his personal respect. He worries about bringing peace into the world, bringing the husband and wife together. We'll come back to Bruria in a minute, but just to understand Chamat, Chamat is an interesting place. Chamat from the word cham, right? Heat, hot springs. So Chamat has natural underground hot springs. They're still there today. There's actually a spa that you can go to that uses these hot springs. And by the ancient synagogue, you can see where the water comes up. And we have interesting halachic questions that arise from these hot springs, right? They're not heated by fire. Are you allowed to use them on Shabbat, right? Very interesting question. I'm not going to read it, but it's a Gemara here in Shabbos that shows how people would kind of circumvent the rules of the rabbis, right? And they would bathe in water that they had heated up on Shabbos and say they were bathing in the hot springs of Tveria because, you know, Jews look for loopholes. That's the hot springs and they're famous. Chamat is the old city. The city that is the continuation of Chamat to the north is Tveria, right? And the Gemara talks about how Chamat and Tveria used to be two separate cities. Eventually they unite into one city. Tveria, as we said, is the last station of the Sanhedrin. It's a newcomer on the map. It's only built in the first century of the Common Era by Herod's son, but it becomes a very, very important Jewish center for centuries, right? The Masorah resides in Tveria. And only very recently has there been serious archaeology being done in ancient Tveria. It really was neglected for a long time. But this is an archaeological park at the southern entrance of Tveria, where you can see it in the drawing, but in the photograph, it really is very clear. You can see the two pillars that are on either side of the gate and the entrance into the city and the main street, the Cardo. And if you keep walking, you'll get to the theater. And all of these things are being unearthed now. Bruria is, as we said, somebody who's very well versed in suffering, unfortunately. Bruria is one of the very few women in rabbinic literature who is not only wise, right? We have wise women. We have women who, you know, give good advice, but she's not just wise, she's learned, right? She's somebody who knows Torah. Rabbis come ask her questions. She learns many halachot. She has a very sharp tongue. She tells off rabbis who she doesn't like, but she's also very compassionate. And the famous story that we have here is the story about her sons dying, right? It's as if she didn't have enough suffering in her life. And it's the story in the Medrash and Mishlei, the story about Rabbi Meir, who was sitting and expounding in the study hall on Shabbat afternoon when two of his sons died. His mother placed them both on the bed and spread a sheet over them. At the end of Shabbat, Rabbi Meir came home from the study hall. He said, "Where are my two sons?" She said, "They went to the study hall." He said, "I scanned the study hall. I did not see him." She gave him the cup of Havdalah. He said, "Havdalah." He said, he repeated, "Where are my sons?" She said, "They went elsewhere. They are coming now." She placed food in front of him. He ate. He blessed. After he blessed, she said to him, "I have a question to ask you." He said to her, "Say your question." She said, "Rabbi, before today, a man came and deposited something with me, and now he is coming to take it. Should we return it to him or not?" He said, "My daughter, one who has a deposit, must return it to his owner." She said to him, "Were it not for your consent, I would not have given it to him." She took his hand, brought him to that room, had him approach the bed, and took the sheet from upon them. When he saw both of them dead and laying upon the bed, he began to cry and say, my sons, my teachers, my sons in the way of the world, my teachers, in that they would enlighten my eyes with their Torah." At that time, she said to Rabbi Meir, "Rebbe, is this not what I told you? Do I not need to return the deposit to its owner?" He said, "The Lord has given and the Lord has taken. May the name of the Lord be blessed." She is wise enough and compassionate enough to break the news to him very slowly and very cautiously, even though her heart was certainly breaking as well. And Bruria really is also somebody who takes from the Bar Kokhba revolt this lesson about suffering, but not only. The picture, by the way, is also from the synagogue in Chamat Tveria, which has depictions of the different seasons as women, right? And this is the season of the winter, Tkufat Tevet. But she also believes in this message of inclusiveness. Even people who don't seem to deserve to be part of the Jewish people, we need them back. Hey, and we have a famous story here in the Gemara in Brachot. There were hooligans in Rabbi Meir's neighborhood who caused him a great deal of anguish. Rabbi Meir prayed for God to have mercy on them, that they should die. Rabbi Meir said, "What are you thinking? Why would you pray for them?" And she says, "Yitamu chata'im min ha'aretz. Let sins cease from the land. Is it written, let sinners cease? Let sins cease. Pray for God," look to the bottom there, "pray for God to have mercy on them, that they should repent. If they repent, then the wicked will be no more as they have repented." Rabbi Meir saw that Bruria was correct. He prayed for God to have mercy on them and they repented. Don't pray for them to die. Pray for them to come back because we need them. Even the ones who go to the theater, it's the picture you have here, we need them. And Rabbi Meir learns this lesson very well. And here's a statement from Kiddushin. "You are sons to the Lord your God, banim atem la'Hashem Elokecha. When you act like sons, you are called sons. But when you do not act like sons, you are not called sons." This is the statement of Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Meir said, either way, you are still called sons. We don't give up on anybody. Right? This is the grave of Rabbi Meir. It's called Rabbi Meir Baal Hanes. There was a famous kupat tzedakah. Still exists. Many people may remember having this in their house, right? The Rabbi Meir Baal Hanes charity fund. What's the nace? The nace is the story. What is the miracle? miracle that he has to go and free Bruria's sister. But of course, he has to go and bribe the jailkeeper in Rome. And the jailkeeper says, well, what am I going to do? I can't let her go because they'll arrest me. And he says, you know what? If you're in trouble, you just say, Eloka de Meir Anenu, God of Meir, answer me, and everything will be okay. And it does, right? Wild, they send wild dogs after him. He says, God of Meir, answer me, and he's saved. And this caused such an uproar that it says that Rabbi Meir's face was put on the gates of Rome, right? It's a wanted poster. Get that Rabbi Meir and take him. Is this really Rabbi Meir's grave? Interesting question. We are not going to go into it. But perhaps the best example of Rabbi Meir learning from everyone is the story of his teacher, Elisha ben Abuya, who loses his name. Okay, he's one of the few scholars that doesn't have his name anymore. He's called Acher, the other. And he's an example of a survivor that goes in another direction. He sees the power of Rome and he can't resist it. And the rabbis don't understand how Rabbi Meir can continue to learn from him when he becomes a heretic, he becomes an apostate. We even have stories that he hands over Jews to the Romans, and yet Rabbi Meir continues to study from him and to learn Torah from him. So we have this Gemara here. Rabbi Shela found Elijah the prophet, said, what is the Holy One, blessed be he, doing? It's always a question people love to ask Elijah. He is stating halachot transmitted by all the sages, but in the name of Rabbi Meir, he will not speak. Why? Because he learned halachot from the mouth of Acher. Acher is thrown out. We're not interested in him. So why should he be judged unfavorably for that, says Rabbi Bar Shela? Rabbi Meir found a pomegranate and ate its contents while throwing away its peel, right? He took what was good and he disregarded all the rest. And he said, your defense has been heard. Now God says, my son Meir says, right? Now God has been convinced that you can listen to somebody who's a sinner if he has Torah to teach. And we have this very extensive story, which I don't think we're going to read, but if you're interested in reading through all of it, it's in the source sheets, of Rabbi Meir and Elisha ben Abuya, where he comes, Elisha riding a horse on Shabbat. Rabbi Meir comes out to walk with him. They learn Torah the whole way until Elisha finally says to him, no, this is the return. This is the edge of the Tchum Shabbat. I've been counting the paces with my horses. Meaning Elisha knows a ton of Torah, but he is seduced by the power of Rome, or perhaps he's so distressed by all the evil that he has seen, all the good people who are suffering, and he forsakes Torah. He forsakes Judaism, but Rabbi Meir still learns from him. And the fascinating thing is when you read through the dialogue that they have, all the corrections that Elisha ben Abuya makes to Rabbi Meir's Torah. He says, oh, no, that's not what Rabbi Akiva said, and that's not what Rabbi Akiva said. They all have to do with repentance, change. Can a person become something different than what he was supposed to be in the beginning, right? All of these different things. And when Elisha says to Rabbi Meir, return, right? It's time for you to go back. You've reached the edge of the Shabbat boundaries. Rabbi Meir says, you return as well. Right? You can also do tshuva. You can also return. And Elisha ben Abuya says, no, I can't. I heard that I'm not allowed to return. But ultimately, he dies with great sorrow. And Rabbi Meir says, my teacher was taken as he repented. And when he's buried, they say, your grave of your teacher is burning. And that's the end of the midrash, is that Elisha ben Abuya does ultimately do tshuva. And Rabbi Meir helps him in that. But I think Elisha is a very important example of a different reaction one could have to this story, which is not defiance and it's not inclusiveness and rebuilding, but it's, wow, these Romans are certainly very, very powerful. There must be a reason for that. There must be a reason why God is allowing them to be so successful, to build cities like Beit Sha'an, because there must be something right about what they're doing. And that seems to be the direction that Elisha ben Abuya is going in. If you want to read a fascinating book about it, which is based on rabbinic sources, although somewhat fictional, Louis Jacobs, conservative rabbi, many decades ago, wrote a book called As a Driven Leaf, a novel about Elisha ben Abuya, and he takes a lot of these sources and he conjectures that this is what's going on. Okay, the final survivor that we're going to look at in the final few minutes that we have is Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. So if Rabbi Meir is inclusiveness and Bruria is accepting suffering and Acher is succumbing to the power of Rome, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai is the non-accommodationist. We will never give up. We will never surrender. He speaks out against the Romans. And this is the very famous passage that I mentioned before. Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, and Rabbi Shimon were sitting. Rabbi Yehuda said, "How pleasant are the actions of this nation. They made marketplaces and bridges and bathhouses." Rabbi Yossi was silent. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai said, "Everything they establish only for their own purposes." And of course, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai gets a price put on his head. He has to go into hiding. He goes out and hides in a cave with his son for 12 years. This, of course, is the origin of the story that this is where the Kabbalah comes from, mysticism, the Zohar, that they're sitting and they're learning Torah all day. But he won't give up. He won't surrender. He is a very, very strong and dogmatic and anti-Roman and pro-Eretz Yisrael. But he's also very strong about how Jews should behave. And he doesn't believe that anybody should spend their time not doing what God asked them to do, which is studying Torah all day long. Okay? And he comes out and he sees people working. And everywhere he looks, things are lit on fire, because how could you work and not be studying Torah? And God says, go back to your cave, right? You have to learn that the world is also made up of work, is also made up of mundane things. If you go to Meron, which is where his grave is, or his grave is supposed to be since at least the 12th century, from the thousands and thousands of people who go to visit the grave, very, very few of them walk 5 minutes up the hill next door to what is most likely the ancient synagogue of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. Hey, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai lived in Meron, as far as we know. He hid out in Pekin. And there is a synagogue from the second century at the top of the hill in Meron. You can see it in the old picture here on the left, where the lintel is about to fall down. And there was a tradition with the Jews of Tzfat that when the lintel fell down, the Messiah would come. Today, it's not so safe. So they actually glued it together. Does that mean Mashiach's not going to come? I don't know. And they added the third archway, as you can see in the modern picture. And this is very likely is the synagogue of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. One of the very famous disagreements that he has with Rabbi Yishmael is, should you work or should you study Torah all day, right? It says that you have to collect your grain. And Rabbi Yishmael says, you learn some Torah and you work as well, right? Set aside time not only for Torah, but also for work. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai says, second paragraph, is it possible that a person plows in the plowing season and sows in the sowing season and harvests in the harvest season and threshes in the threshing season and winnows in the windy season? What will become of Torah? Torah Mateheala, you're going to be so busy doing your work. When are you going to learn Torah? When Israel performs God's will, their work is performed by others. When Israel does not perform God's will, their work is performed by themselves. So rather than working, spend your time studying Torah. Perhaps this is also a reaction to the story of Bar Kokhba, that we don't have time to waste on mundane things. And yet, Abaye said, many have acted in accordance with the opinions of Rabbi Yishmael and were successful. Many have acted in accordance with the opinion of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai and were not successful. So this is not necessarily an approach that will work for everyone. Finally, this is the grave of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai in Meron. Of course, most famous for people coming to visit on Lag BaOmer. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai is considered the father of Jewish mysticism and the Zohar and Kabbalah. Many centuries later, the mystics in Tzfat come to Tzfat because of the influence of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. Just finished with one kind of strange story, funny story. The picture on the right was a picture from before 1948, when not only Jews would come to the grave of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, but also Druze. Okay? This is a great story from Velvel Pasternak, who learned that the song, which was considered a Breslov Niggin, the Mizerlu, is actually a Druze song, because it's not Breslov at all. How did the Breslov learn it? They would go to the grave of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai on the 7th of Adar, which is the yahrzeit of Moshe Rabbeinu. We don't know where Moshe is buried, so they would go to Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. The Druze would come as well, because the Druze revere Yitro. They could not get to the grave of Nebi Shu'iv, of Yitro's grave in 1948, before 1948. And they would come, and everybody would sing, and everybody would dance, and the Breslov learned the Druze songs, and that's why they sing the Mizerlu. So that's just a great story by Velvel Pasternak. Okay, so we saw basically the reactions to the revolt, the rebuilding. Next week, we're going to draw this historical section to a close and try to understand Rebbe and his generation and how they solidify the study of the Torah Shabbat Peh, of the oral law. So let's see what questions we have. Questions, going back to the top. Okay. How long will they continue to call it new? I'm not sure what that is referring to. Are the references to Elia Capitolina in Chazal? Not as the name, not the word Elia Capitolina, but we definitely hear about the Romans coming and the Romans taking over and not allowing Jews into the city. Why would they use the Latin lettering to indicate the tchum? That's a good question. And it's not so clear that this is really the tchum stone. This is how it's interpreted. I would agree with you that the Latin letter does seem to be a little bit strange. Rabbi Akiva was relatively old when he was ordained. How come the Usha enactments are not recorded in the Mishnah? We hear about them in the Gemara. And there are a few here and there in the Mishnah. I would not say that I am an expert in every place where it talks about the Takanot Usha, but you're right. It's not the same like we have with Yavne, where we have Takanot Yavne that are set out in this very nice and organized way. Elisha ben Abuya, we saw Elisha ben Abuya. I did not send my slides to distribute, but there is a source sheet that is on the Torah Moshe website. Interesting, our ancestors didn't have a problem with pictures of women. Some of them did, some of them didn't. In that same synagogue in Chamat Tveria, we also have pictures of the zodiac. We also have pictures of Helios, the sun god, in a chariot. So we're going to talk a little bit about that next week when we talk about Tzipori. There are many Rabbi Meir Bahaneses. Yes. It's a fundraising gold mine. Okay, Acher says, late Din, late Dayan. Yes, Acher is a classic example of why do bad things happen to good people? Yes, Milton Steinberg. I said Louis Jacobs. I apologize, Milton Steinberg. You are correct. Thank you for the correction. As a driven leaf. Yes, there are many, many stories about Elisha ben Abuya. I only brought you a little bit. There's a lot to talk about. Mizrlu, it's a Mizrahi kind of a tune. Na, 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 na. You can Google it. Olav HaShalom. Who is Olav HaShalom? I don't know.
Pasternak.
Link to the song. I'll send a link to the song. Oh, Velvel Pasternak, yes. His daughter is actually the one who brought the story, Shira Pasternak Be'eri. But yeah, he was a real storyteller. I will send that article to Rabbi Kelman and he can distribute it to everybody. Okay.
Thank you. We do actually have a talk from a number of years ago on Tisha B'Av, Dr. Jimmy Diamond, whom some of you may know was a professor of Jewish studies, an expert on the Rambam, published a number of works. So he gave a whole talk on Elisha ben Abuya. I can have to find it on our website if anybody's really interested. They gave a whole hour talk, right? There's lots to say on Elisha ben Abuya. Anyways, thank you very much. You know, Shuli, always a pleasure. This evening, 8:30, Nechama Price, our Parshat HaShavuah here. Nechama Price is the director of GPATH, the graduate program in Advanced Talmud Study for Women at Stern College. Everybody's welcome. Sunday is Rabbi Liebtag's last class in his series from King Cyrus to Lord Balfour. So this is the last of the series. I think it's the 21st part, if I'm not mistaken. Sunday at 11:15, followed at 12:30. By Rabbanit Chana Henkin talking about the tshuvot of her husband, Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henkin. So go to the website and register. We sent out a link a couple of days ago. And then all our regular classes next week, we're sort of gearing into Pesach mode. Rabbi Adler started this week and Benny Gesundheit is going to start the week after that. And anyways, follow the emails. We look forward to learning with you and your friends and everybody be well, be healthy. And okay, Shabbat Shalom for those who won't see and those this evening. And if you can make it, we'd love to see you. And thank you very much. Have a great day, everybody.